Number 06-1650, Peterson, Releasogen Manufacturing and Cut Clean Chem against Arkona, Clean Products, and Stephen Hodges. Mr. Perry.
Good morning and thank you, Your Honor. This case calls into question two different Rule 56s. Rule 56 of the Rules of Civil Procedure and what's known as Rule 56 of the PTO's regulations, which is 37 CFR 1.56, which is known as the duty of candor rule. In this case, what happened? The central important policy principle that this court is reviewing today deals with the fact that the rightful inventor, the rightful sole inventor, was totally excluded in the patent application process. And a person who did not invent submitted a declaration to the PTO stating that he was the sole and only inventor of the patented product in this case. The district court's decision not only engaged...
I thought the issue, the case was about an implied license to assign, a shop right.
Hired to invent.
Yes, I'm sorry.
It is, Your Honors. But
hired to invent, yes.
This duty of candor is an overarching consideration subsumed within in these issues. It's basically a sub-issue, but it's a very important policy consideration in this case.
But Mr. Perry, if in fact the court below was correct in determining that we have a hired to invent situation, then we don't get to what did or did not happen before the PTO, although I realize there may be some equitable considerations in the ShopRite issue. But where do you say the district court made error on the determination that it was made with respect to hired to invent?
Your Honor, on the hired to invent issue, that question is kind of a classic question of fact. In other words, is there evidence that was presented sufficient to try the issue of whether or not the parties had a meeting of the minds, basically an oral agreement, where the plaintiff wholesale assigned his patent rights to the defendant. Under the Minnesota case, which is the primary precedent that the courts are obligated to follow if there is any state law case on the issue, we have the Dean versus Hodge case out of Minnesota, very old, over a century old, but there was actually a presumption in that case of compensation if there's evidence, even if where there was significant acquiescence on the plaintiff's part.
In other words, this case isn't about whether Mr. Peterson was either a sole or joint inventor.
That was certainly an issue in the trial court. I don't believe it's an issue on appeal, though.
I think that's my reading of the brief.
Because the court really didn't quite get to that issue?
In other words, even assuming he was, that's the posture of the case.
Yes, right. It is, Your Honor. Although there's a, when I talk about shop rights, it kind of, the sole inventorship issue winds its way back into the case under the equitable considerations that I was talking about under Rule 1.56. What happened, Your Honors, in this case, all of the evidence, and we've listed it at page 44 to 45 of our brief, there's a bullet point list of a collection of the key evidence on the hired to invent issue that shows that there was, from the get-go, Mr. Peterson wanted compensation and insisted on compensation. There's an affidavit that was submitted that shows the $1,450 he was paid was not intended to be full compensation for the development and the use of the product. The defendant's own vice president admitted that Mr. Peterson wanted a sole supplier relationship in order to compensate for the use of the product. The invent for hire cases such as Teats, for example, that the defendants relied upon and the trial court relied upon, I'll deal with a situation where there was really no discussion of compensation. We have presented admissible evidence to raise fact questions on whether there was an intent between the parties, basically an oral contract or an implied contract, for a wholesale assignment of any and all ownership rights away from Mr. Peterson to a Kona.
But if he was hired to invent, to do this, then isn't that all the risk of the case? If he was hired to invent, then that settles in there was compensation for his work, obviously, right?
There was some compensation. In answer to your question, Your Honor, I believe the answer to that question is no. I mean, we can engage in labeling something as hired to invent or as a shop right, but there's more to the analysis. Because under
the shop right sort of assumes he's an employee already. So
it does. It's kind of
hired to invent seems to fit, if anything does, closer.
I think that's probably the more direct defense here. But what we're dealing with here is the defendant, the court concluded as a matter of law that there was no evidence to overcome the meeting of the minds standard. Because simply, if a defendant in this case simply hires somebody to invent, it depends on the facts and the circumstances to know what the scope of that employment was, what the compensation was, what the intent of the parties was. Those questions are all inherently fact questions. And hired to invent, the case law, as Teets teaches us, is that it basically is an implied contract to assign patent rights, and there has to be a meeting of the minds between the parties in order for that to occur. And that's where the fact issues become apparent in this case. And this is where we had competing evidence submitted by the defendants.
But in the absence of something expressed to the contrary, if someone is hired to invent, isn't it clear that the hirer owns the property?
No. If hired to invent is an ultimate conclusion where the court, after considering the facts, has looked at the facts and found that there was a meeting of the minds between the parties to transfer and assign patent rights implicitly, then the answer to your question would be yes. But if there's a fact dispute as to whether or not there was a meeting of the minds, which is exactly what we have here.
If I hire you to invent, if you're the inventor, certainly that goes on the patent, you're the inventor. But if I hire you to invent, isn't it implied that I own the invention? I mean, even in the absence of an express agreement, corporations hire people to invent all the time. And common law gives them those rights. Usually, if they're up to date, they have express agreements. But isn't there an implication there?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. There really isn't. It all goes back to the meeting of the minds issue. There may be a shop right. It depends on, you know, did the person who was hired use some of their own resources? Did they use the employer's resources? Was there an intent to assign?
Well, those are shop right considerations. Whose resources we use, whether it's on company time.
They are, but I think there's also some carryover to the hired to invent issue because of the fact that the court, in order to arrive at the conclusion of the meeting of the minds, just simply doesn't, or shouldn't, we argue, look solely at the question of, or to put a label on the situation and arrive at a conclusion based on the label. And here, there was all kinds of evidence of the intent for future compensation, of, you know, a pittance to develop a multi-million dollar product for $1,450, where the invoice that was submitted specifically stated that there was going to have to be a sole supplier relationship for the use of the product. And all of those things go to the the question of whether there was a meeting of the minds or not, and we submit that that's a material fact issue.
So are you not relying on the confidentiality agreement or any provisions?
We are, and of course, as indicated in the brief, if the court determines there were fact issues as to whether the NDA, the non-disclosure agreement, precluded a transfer of the intellectual property, then you don't even get to hire two inventor shop rights in the first place because there's an express contract.
Of course, Pedersen is the plaintiff here.
Yes.
He wasn't party to that agreement.
Your Honor, if that's the case, then he wasn't hired to invent either because his corporations were paid for the invention, not him. And that is in our reply brief where we indicated that the defendants are trying to have that argument both ways. On the one hand, they argue that Pedersen was paid the $25 an hour. He wasn't. His corporation was paid $25 an hour.
This is a mess.
I.e., a fact question.
The invoice says compensation. Compensation agreed upon by Howell, Hodges, and Pedersen. So, I mean, that looks like it's to Pedersen.
It does. But the parties were clearly dealing in a corporate-to-corporate capacity on the payment issue because there's no dispute, and the evidence shows that the check, the invoice was submitted to Acona on Releasagen letterhead. The check from Acona was payable to Releasagen. And I don't want to have it both ways here. The reality is that we're dealing with individuals who are acting through corporations. There's a clear agency relationship in place. The NDA is crucial. There are fact questions as to whether there were disclosures under the NDA or not under the NDA. The judge and the defendants argue that the disclosures all occurred prior to May 26th, but there was experimentation that we submitted in the record taking place on May 27th. And the final formula was on June 4th. This case is replete with fact questions, and Your Honors, I think the court just simply engaged in fact-finding here, should have allowed this case to be tried, and that's all we're asking for. I see my...
Yes, you're into your rebuttal time. Let's hear from the other side, and we'll
save you, Your Honor.
On the way back, I see your firm is Perry, Perry, and Perry. Are you the first, the second, or the third?
I'm in the middle one, Your Honor.
Mr. Morton.
Please report, good morning. I represent Defendants Clean Products, formerly known as Acona, and Stephen Hodges. I'll probably refer to it as Acona because that was the name of the company in all the documents and all the depositions. As I think the court has pointed out here today, we're not here to decide if Pedersen is the inventor. My motion, the district court's order, assumes that he is. And we're also really not in this litigation because of an oral contract for a 5-year supply where Pedersen got 3.5 years of supply, or his protection of rights argument. We're here because Pedersen wants money for patent infringement. We're here really only because my client filed a patent. According to Pedersen, because Acona filed for a patent while he did nothing, Acona created a right for him to sue them for patent infringement. And that just can't be the case, and it isn't the case under the law or the facts. Very crucially, I thought, in the reply brief, Pedersen admits that Acona had no duty to file a patent application on his behalf. They could have done absolutely nothing, and we would not be here today. There would not be any lawsuit. Pedersen would have no claim. The idea that he can now join Acona unless they pay a royalty just can't be correct. And the district court can see that, and that's why there's summary judgment granted on multiple grounds on the contract issues and the patent issues. And I think the main thing to point out there, this is a case that's on summary judgment, on appeal, and the district court's order is based entirely on documents that I put in front of Pedersen and he authenticated and admissions that he made. All those facts that are what I relied on in this motion are not in dispute. The case is ripe for summary judgment. And I can go through some of those on the various grounds that the district court has granted summary judgment. First of all, there's
But you're saying the only issue was inventorship and that the other issues which are raised in the briefs were not before the district court, such as an implied obligation to pay for use of what was developed, setting the patent aside, for instance.
The basis of the motion was that the oral contract, there's supposedly an oral contract for a 5-year suppliership, and payment for time while working on the product, and the protection of rights, a very ambiguous clause. And the basis of the motion was that those things were invalid under the statute of frauds, also that no reasonable jury could find any of those existed, and the court also found that protection of rights was too vague to enforce. So those are the issues with the contracts, and I think that they're completely correct. I mean, the idea of a 5-year contract is clearly more than 1 year, clearly falls under the statute of frauds. Also, this was for more than $500, falls under the statute of frauds. There's no serious argument that it's not, and there's no written evidence of a 5-year deal. There's no written evidence of protection of rights. Nothing obviously signed by Acona. I think the critical piece of evidence there that shows there's just nothing about this extra compensation for use of the invention is the only thing signed by Acona was their offer to Pedersen. We'll give you a long-term supply deal. There was a blank number of years. We'll give you a long-term deal in return for the name of your supplier because we're just concerned about the reliability of the supply. Undisputed fact, Pedersen rejected it. That was the end of the discussions on the contract. He did not accept a long-term deal because he wouldn't give up his supplier. After that, they just started operating on an order-by-order basis. And there's no more discussion about full compensation or compensation for use of the invention. That's just not written anywhere. It just does not exist.
What was the total compensation Pedersen got for all of this?
He requested his hourly rate to be $25 an hour. He billed 52 hours. That was $1,350, I think. Plus he put a little expenses on there. He was also paid for his expense, so it was $1,450. And then he got what was really his goal. If you look at these facts, it's very clear he wanted to supply superabsorbent to Acona. That was the goal, and he achieved that. He got to be the supplier. And they bought from him for 3.5 years. I haven't worked up what the... I don't know the exact amount that he was paid over that time, but he got multiple truckloads at $8,000 to $10,000 a truckload over those years. So that's the compensation that he bargained for. That's the compensation that he received. And at this point, as far as any like contract issue, I think plaintiffs are now relying entirely on this NDA. And I want to point out why the NDA is just irrelevant on at least 4 different grounds. First of all, this is it's an NDA. It's not an agreement about inventorship rights while you're employed or anything like that.
Well, inventorship rights go by law. You can't contract away your right to be an inventor if you're an inventor.
That's correct, Your Honor. So they're not about ownership rights, or it's not, I won't assign my invention if I work for you, or I will assign it. It's just not addressing that.
Second, so on summary judgment, there's no question as to inventorship. Is that right?
Is there a question as to inventorship?
Yeah.
This summary judgment motion assumes the facts as Pedersen states them, that he is the inventor. There is an issue with the case about inventorship.
Does it assume sole inventorship or joint?
Sole inventorship. I had an alternate theory, and it is present on appeal that you could affirm based on the fact that they cannot show clear and convincing evidence that Stephen Hodges, my client, is not an inventor. Under the Thompson v. Haynes case, that's their standard. It's not just that they have evidence that Pedersen is an inventor. They have to prove that Hodges, by clear and convincing evidence, is not an inventor. So that is an alternate ground. It's not the centerpiece of the district court's decision is based on.
Well, but there was summary judgment, so it's not an alternate ground for anything, is it? I mean, on summary judgment, we have to accept the assertion of inventorship and either also accept as a matter of law some other theory, such as ShopRite or assignment. But again, this is summary judgment, and yes, these are factual questions.
Yes. I mean, the district court's decision and the focus of the appeal absolutely assumes that Pedersen is the sole inventor.
So Pedersen's the sole inventor. There's a patent owned by now Acona, which names Hodges, not Pedersen.
Yes.
But that's not the challenge on appeal here, right? The challenge is ownership,
ownership,
not inventorship.
Exactly.
Not inventorship.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, I can come back to the NDA, but on the ownership of the patent issue, the district court granted on two grounds, hire to invent and ShopRite. So under the hire to invent doctrine, obviously, Pedersen is required to assign any rights he has to a Acona. Under ShopRite, Acona simply has the right to use.
But which is the stronger argument in your view?
I don't think there's a stronger argument. I think they both are based on absolutely undisputed facts that just line up exactly with the primary cases we've cited. The Teats case.
The ShopRite assumes an employee relationship.
Yes.
A hire-to-invent situation doesn't necessarily, or does it? You can hire an independent contractor to invent, right?
If you look at the McElmurry decision, which is the main decision that we're relying on.
Out of Minnesota?
No, Federal Circuit decision. Footnote, I believe it's 15, says that it doesn't matter if you're an independent contractor. And so I rely on that to say if he's an independent contractor in that situation, that's fine. He is still very clearly hired to invent. And that is the primary fact on the hired to invent side, is that he was hired to work solely on this product. I mean, there's no question. This is it. This is the only thing he was hired to do. He wanted to do it. He did it. He was paid for his time. It was the whole point.
He's hired to develop a product that his company would supply. Is that the same as hired to invent as an independent contractor?
Well, he's not exactly developing a whole product. Acona had a product called CleanSweep that they were manufacturing and selling. They had $500,000 or $600,000 in sales a year at the time, and they just had an issue with it. They needed to do something to help with this dry out problem, and they were working on it. So this project is just to add one ingredient to the mix.
Okay, but does that change anything?
I don't believe it does. I mean, that's a separate thing that he wanted to do.
I mean,
later.
Then why? I didn't think it changed anything. That's why I was wondering why he was emphasizing as to whether it was one ingredient or two ingredients.
Oh, yeah. I'm just explaining the fact pattern in front of the court. I don't think that it makes any difference. He was hired to do what he was hired to do, and he's also supplying.
It's in the business of providing ingredients. And so a potential customer says, I have a problem, and he figures out how to solve the problem for which he provides the ingredients. I'm trying to, as a different company, different ND, is obviously not an employee of Acona. So when you go to a potential supplier and say, I have a problem, can you solve it? Automatically, that entity, that person loses all rights?
Perhaps if they did everything on their own and were going to design this anyway, it'd be a different case. I mean, in this case...
Well, this is summary judgment as well, so there are some questions as to what was understood or agreed that really can't be resolved against Pedersen on summary judgment.
Well, the undisputed facts of what was agreed is what he asked for. He asked to work for Acona. He asked for $25 an hour.
He wanted to be paid for the time that he was spending to develop the product.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's the same as being hired to invent. That's covering his out of pocket, not necessarily an assignment of all rights in everything that results from that hourly payment.
I think if an independent contractor can be hired to invent, then you're going to have that situation most of the time. He also spent a lot of his time at Acona, by his estimation, at least 40% of his time at Acona using their equipment. And other factors the court looks at are that Acona paid for the prosecution that eventually happened, and Pedersen never disputed that they could do.
Pedersen helped in the prosecution?
Pedersen helped in the prosecution, exactly, and at that time didn't dispute that Hodges was an inventor.
But he asked to be included, did he not, from the beginning?
He says that he asked to be listed as an inventor when he was helping with the prosecution, that's correct. But he didn't say anything about ownership. He didn't say anything. I asked him at every stage in the development, did you ever tell Acona they couldn't make this product without your permission? No. Did you ever tell them you owned the patent? No. Did you ever, anything like that? I asked him when they were negotiating in 98. I asked him when he helped with the patent in 2000, when he found out the patent issued in 2000. When he was dumped as a supplier in 2001, he still didn't say anything like, I own the patent, you can't make Clean Sweep, you owe me a royalty, never, anything like that. He supplied again in 2003, didn't say anything. 2004, he bid, didn't say anything. Even when his first lawyer contacted the company, they just said he should be listed as an inventor. It wasn't until this lawsuit, it was the first time he ever said, I should own the patent, you can't make the product without my permission, you owe me a royalty if you do. That kind of bleeds into the other legal theory of applied license that occurs over the period of his time as a supplier. But when you look at it all together, I mean, it's a very clear situation that he was hired to invent, and there's a shop right and an applied license based on their ongoing dealings.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Morton.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Perry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse my voice. At page 42 to 43 of our opening brief, we quote from the Banks versus Unisys decision, which was this court's last word on the hired to invent test. And Judge Laurie, you were asking the questions earlier, does merely being hired to invent answer the question you have before you? This court in Banks, and I'm quoting now from page 1359 of the Banks decision and page 42 of my brief, held that an implied in fact contract is an agreement founded upon a meeting of the minds, which although not embodied in an express contract, is inferred as a fact from the conduct of the parties, showing in light of the surrounding circumstances that their tacit understanding. When applying the employed to invent exception, a court must examine the employment relationship at the time of the inventive work to determine if the parties entered into an implied in fact contract to assign patent rights. State contract principles provide for the rules for identifying and enforcing implied in fact contracts. Then on top of page 43, I cite from the Teats case, or quotes from the Teats case, in which this court held, the existence of an implied in fact contract to assign inventive rights is a question of fact. And then we discuss Minnesota law below that reaffirms and is consistent with federal circuit law that the existence of an implied in fact contract is a fact question. And that's where we think the crux of this case depends on or comes down to in terms of the fact issues. The other thing that I'd like to go back to the rule 1.56, the duty of candor issue, because that really is important here. If Acona had honestly in the declaration to the PTO claimed that Mr. Peter Pedersen was either a sole or a joint inventor, even if it was a joint inventorship, we probably wouldn't be here today because they would have been going through the process through what I consider to be the front door. They would have needed an assignment for Mr. Pedersen to transfer that patent to Akona. They didn't do that. They didn't even tell Mr. Pedersen they were applying for a patent. And they knew full well that Mr. Pedersen was the sole inventor. And this was another fact issue that's buried in the shop rights analysis, but this whole question of who came up with the idea to add superabsorbent. Well, the story that Mr. Hodges tells was that he learned about superabsorbent from a demonstration 5 years earlier that Mr. Pedersen and Mr. Minkema did for
him. Well, Mr. Morton says that the record is replete with the history of Mr. Pedersen not having asked to be, not having pressed any inventorship rights through the several years. It's very hard to ask us here now to say that he was entitled to have done so, could have done so, and we're going to fix it, even though he made no attempt to fix it for himself.
Well, the question, and I believe this is a big fact question in and of itself, Your Honor, is was there acquiescence here, or was there trust and reliance? Mr. Pedersen's affidavit indicates that, and his testimony, that he asked that his name be put on the patent. He's a very unsophisticated guy. He didn't have counsel at the time. He was relying on Akona's patent counsel to protect his rights, and he says so in his affidavit. And relying on Mr. Hodges' assurance that his rights would be protected. Mr. Pedersen also, his affidavit also indicates that the only other times he was involved in patents was when he was at General Mills and another company where he had to sign a document assigning all his rights. Here the concepts are just the opposite. Mr. Pedersen did ask to be protected. Yes, there was delay. He went to counsel eventually, couldn't find the documents. The lawyer told him he couldn't do anything without the documents, and when the documents surfaced, he pressed his rights forward here. But whether there's acquiescence waiver sufficient to give us the opportunity to test the defendant's defense at trial is a question of fact in and of itself. And remember that what the trial judge court did here, Your Honors, is he ruled that the defenses were established as a matter of law. This is something the defendants had the burden of proving. We presented material, admissible facts to challenge every assertion that was made upon which the judge relied. And, I mean, I can understand the acquiescence argument. And a jury may agree with that. A jury may say that Mr. Pedersen waited too long or acquiesced as opposed to not being entitled to trust the defendants. But that's a fact issue, unless there's no facts in dispute. And that we just don't have that situation here. We have all kinds of facts in dispute on every issue that the judge decided this case upon. And the other thing, going back to the policy, to allow Akona to have a government-granted monopoly that it acquired based on a false declaration that it submitted to the PTO, and then to be given basically a bulletproof vest for successfully pulling off the heist, if you want to think of it that way, doesn't seem right to us, okay, or right. Fair.
I think we have to wrap it up, Mr. Perry. We're over time.
Thank you, Judge. Oh, yeah. Your Honor, I just wanted to, can I just comment real quickly on one question that you asked Mr. Morton? You asked if there were other claims asserted below besides the patent infringement and that didn't depend on the contracts per se, and there were. We alleged unjust enrichment as well as an implied contract for payment under the Dean versus Hodges.
And are those claims still pending?
Yes, they are. And we submitted in the briefs that those claims were improperly reversed as well. This isn't solely a patent infringement case, and it's not in that posture up here.
I'm sorry, I asked if they were still pending, and you said no or yes?
Oh, they're before the court, but they were dismissed as part of the summary judgment.
Oh, all right. Okay.
And it's our position that they were improperly dismissed because of all the fact questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Perry. Mr. Morton, case is taken under submission.
Thank you.